tuning in on their television sets, and hopefully that'll get a few of them here in a little more prompt fashion. I do appreciate Representative Schrader joining us at this time, and I do know that Representative Lowe is detained in another hearing. Representative Beck is also on his way, and the Majority Leader is in a similar situation, so hopefully they'll join us as soon as they can. Appreciate those of you who are in the audience being with us today. This is an opportunity for us to hear some more invited testimony and some public testimony about Measure 7. I'll just start with a couple of introductory comments that we're continuing to meet with all the various interested parties on this issue, and if I had to give an appraisal of our chances of success today, I would say that they are reasonable. People are continuing to meet and continuing to be participants in the process, continuing to come forward with good ideas and suggestions, and I think all of that is positive. The purpose of this meeting was to hopefully flesh out some additional information for committee members by some various parties who have continued to look at this issue and have some things to offer that I think are worthy of the committee's consideration. So with that, I would like to bring forward Deidre Molander, Project Director for Oregon Business Council, and John, I'm going to screw your last name up, Tapogna. Okay, Taponia. All right, good. Silent G there. We'll bring John forward and ask you two to begin our hearing today.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Williams and Representative Schrader, for the opportunity to talk with you this afternoon. The Oregon Business Council, after ballot measure 7 was passed, wanted to get a little bit more information about the broader issues associated with regulatory takings and landowner compensation. In order to accomplish that goal, we hired Echo Northwest to produce the report, which we have submitted to you earlier. One of the things I want to make clear is that the recommendations in the report do not reflect the official position of the Oregon Business Council. However, we think that the report is a useful tool for people like yourselves and others that are working on this issue, and that is why we made it public. At this point, I'd like to turn the testimony over to John Taponia. Mr. Taponia is a project manager at Echo Northwest, and he formerly worked for the Congressional Budget Office in Washington, D.C. With that, I'll turn it over to John.
Thank you, Deidre.
Hi. Good afternoon. As Deidre said, I'm John Taponia. I'm a project manager in Echo Northwest's Portland office. It's a firm that's operated in Oregon since 1974. We appreciate the opportunity to testify on what we believe to be a very important public policy issue facing Oregonians, namely that of regulatory takings. Earlier this year, the Oregon Business Council retained the services of our firm to conduct an evaluation of Measure 7 and the issues it raises. Rather than focus on the details of the measure itself, the OBC asked us to address the broader questions about regulatory takings and related compensation systems. Specifically, they sought answers to the following questions. First, how do regulatory takings occur? Second, is the current system for compensating property owners for alleged cases of regulatory takings adequate? And third, if the answer to the second question is no, what are the appropriate public policy responses? And more specifically, what would be the characteristics of a fair and efficient compensation system? So my testimony will focus on the answers to those key questions. Our report was co-authored by five members of our firm, including me. The others were Ed Whitelaw, Echo's president and member of the Oregon Progress Board, Randall Pozdina, the managing director of our Portland office and chair of the Oregon Investment Council, Terry Moore, an expert on Oregon's land use planning system and recent contributor to the governor's growth management report, and James Evenhoe, a planner and economist in our Portland office. So now on to OBC's questions. To answer the question about the underlying causes of regulatory takings, we first had to consider why government is in the regulation business to begin with. Governments occasionally need to influence the activities that take place on land because landowners can impose what economists call externalities on their neighbors. For example, a noisy industrial shop imposes negative effects or costs on neighboring homes, and without some governmental action, the shop may produce more noise than the neighborhood desires. In such cases, governments use regulations to strike a balance between the community's dual desires for a quiet environment and economic growth. With that in mind, there are two ways regulators can trigger a regulatory takings. First, they may impose a regulation that economists would consider economically inefficient. That is, through imperfect information, government may enact a regulation or rule that makes society as a whole worse off. In the industrial shop example, they may enact a noise regulation so severe that the firm leaves the area and takes jobs with it. Meanwhile, the neighbors may have been willing to put up with a little additional noise in order to hold on to those jobs. Second, regulators can enact a rule that is efficient but is inequitable. That is, a regulation makes society as a whole better off, but in doing so, some particular landowners are made worse off. For example, some economists would argue that rural landowners have borne a disproportionate share of the costs related to achieving the benefits associated with urban growth controls. In cases in which a regulation is inefficient, inequitable, or both, regulatory takings occur. In those instances where a regulation is efficient but inequitable, so-called regulatory givings should outweigh the regulatory takings. Reasonable parties can disagree, as do the authors of our report, on how often regulators miss their mark and by how much. However, there is no question, given the imprecision of the regulatory approach, that regulatory takings occur from time to time. Moving now to OBC's second question, namely, were the remedies available to landowners that existed prior to Measure 7 adequate when regulatory takings did occur? Prior to Measure 7, the primary avenue for relief if a landowner believed they had suffered a regulatory takings were the courts. But the law is ambiguous at best about the appropriate remedy for an alleged regulatory taking. The body of case law that has evolved in the courts, as we understand it, generally tolerates government actions that promote the common good and establishes a high burden of proof for the property owner who claims to prove a regulatory taking. In fact, one study of takings cases at the federal level found that federal courts were unlikely to find a taking if a regulation reduced a property's value by less than 80%. Proponents of compensation systems similar to Measure 7 criticize existing legal system remedies because of the difficulty that property owners have in establishing a case for compensation. They point to two main hurdles. First, the high costs incurred and time spent in legal action, and second, the high threshold of the loss in value that must be proven for a regulatory taking to be found. It appears that by passing Measure 7, the majority of Oregon voters were expressing a view that the courts do not always provide adequate relief when regulators enact rules that are either inefficient or unfair. And we generally agree with the voters and believe that some property owners bear a disproportionate share of the cost of achieving the public benefits that regulations strive for. Having come to that conclusion, we believe there are two courses of action for policymakers in Oregon to remedy the problem. First, lawmakers should reform the regulatory process to limit instances of regulatory takings. Our report identifies a number of candidate policies, including replacing regulations with market-based transactions wherever feasible. For example, state and local governments could adopt the principles embedded in the purchase of development rights method, where government simply buys property on the open market when it wishes to protect it from a market use. Alternatively, governments could replace some land use regulations with bidding schemes, similar to those used by companies, bidding for other companies in merger and acquisition transactions. Other candidate reforms include limited vested development rights, performance-based zoning, and transfer development rights, which we outline in detail in our report. Second, Oregon should develop and implement a workable compensation system. Through our review of Measure 7, we have concluded that it contains too many ambiguities, particularly related to retroactivity, to serve as an efficient and fair compensation system. In our view, a workable compensation system would have the following five characteristics. First, it would be exclusively prospective in nature. We would exempt existing regulations because governments enacted those rules within the confines of the U.S. and Oregon constitutions even if the courts interpreted these constitutions in ways that fostered inefficient or inequitable outcomes, we believe that attempting to overturn decades of governmental and judicial decisions would create an arbitrary pattern of winners and losers. Prospectivity would greatly simplify the system and would alleviate the need for governments to provide compensation for regulations they enacted without knowing that compensation was eventually going to be required. Second, courts should estimate compensation as of the date the regulation goes into effect. The language of Measure 7 is unclear about the point in time at which a court should estimate compensation. A preferred compensation system would compare the fair market value of the property with and without the regulation as of the date the regulation went into effect. Through such a process, other factors that have affected the property's value since then, such as economic growth, would not be factored into the compensation amount. Third, in developing the compensation system, policymakers should consider a minimum value threshold. Not all losses in property value should trigger compensation. The current court system tends to award compensation only if the loss in value is between about 80 and 100% of the property's value. That high level of the existing threshold is one of our key critiques of the existing system. If, on the other hand, Oregon implements a policy without a threshold, as in Measure 7, Oregon's governments and courts would be committed to a lot of paperwork that could largely offset the value of compensation. The question of precisely where to set that threshold is an issue of fairness that should be left to policymakers.
Thanks.
Fourth, courts should recognize demand constraints. A revised measure should direct courts to take overall market demand conditions into account when considering claims. If the government can demonstrate that there is not sufficient demand for a proposed land use, the property owner should not be entitled to full compensation. In other words, if four neighboring landowners, each claiming that they could build a regional mall on their adjacent properties, all came forward for compensation, the court should not award each of those property owners claims to compensation equal to their ability to build a regional mall. Finally, policymakers should establish a method for financing compensation. Current law constrains government's taxing authority in a number of ways, and a compensation system will need to have some new funding options. One option is the use of a so-called givings tax, which would pay compensation for property owners subject to the regulatory taking by using proceeds from a tax on the increment of the same increment that the same regulation adds to the value of other properties in the relevant area. So in conclusion, our report finds the following. First, we believe that regulatory takings are not rare and are the outcome of a necessary but inherently imperfect regulatory process. Moreover, we agree with the majority of Oregon voters that some property owners bear a disproportionate share of the costs associated with the benefits that regulations strive for. By implementing non-regulatory approaches and a workable compensation system, policymakers could achieve a more equitable regulatory environment. So with that, I thank you for your time, and we are certainly available for questions if you have questions about our report.
Thank you very much, John and Deidre. Let me start by saying that I appreciate the work that the Oregon Business Council did in hiring Echo Northwest and asking them to prepare this report. It's one of the few pieces I think we've seen thus far that seems to be based on some real research and some thought put into it. And I know it was welcome reading for me as the chairman of this committee. And I want to thank you, John, for taking the time to come down and speak with us today. I'd like to ask committee members if they have any questions for Mr. DePagna or Ms. Mullender. Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm interested in the givings tax that you've described here. Are you saying that the surrounding property owners would pay a higher tax because government takes a piece of property in that area? Is that the way it works?
The notion there is that if a regulation is efficient, it has made the area and society in general better off in total. But within that area, there are winners and losers. And the regulatory takings claims relate to the individuals who have lost coming forward and seeking claims for compensation. But again, if the regulation was a good idea and it was efficient, there should be more landowners who gained value in property through the passage of that regulation, and they should, an efficient compensation scheme would try to take some of that increased value from those property owners and transfer it to those who have lost. Society in the total is still better off, but we have sort of evened out the windfalls and the so-called wipeouts.
Follow up. So if it's, say, it's a park or it's a bike path, something like that, and there is no value to the surrounding properties, they would still be taxed, would they not?
Your argument there would be that the bike path is not creating value for the surrounding properties. So if the property owners in that area said the bike path was of no value to them, then you would have an argument there. An appraiser could tell you whether the existence of a bike path or some other amenity, public amenity, did factor into the value of the surrounding homes.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Schrader.
How should we deal? I really appreciate the report, and I appreciate your summary here and the five key points you think we need to address. I think that is helpful, and we'll certainly look at that. But was also looking at how do we deal with federal regulations? Oftentimes that seems to be a big burden for a lot of people, particularly in the rural areas, and given the limited jurisdictional capabilities we have, was there any discussion in your report or among yourselves as to how we could deal with that?
I know there is a debate going on at the federal level with respect to federal takings, but Measure 7 explicitly did not address those concerns. I am unaware of any other state level or local level regulatory takings programs across the country that would try to take on the federal issues as well. I guess the short answer is no, we did not look into that, but I am aware that there is a debate going on at that level as well. One of the sort of the clearest and best reports that we've seen on the takings issue in general was completed by the Congressional Budget Office. And I don't say that because I'm an alum of that agency, but they did do a report for Congress in 1998 on the takings issue at the federal level and proposed compensation systems, particularly related to wetlands.
Thank you. Representative Beck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious about your last recommendation for a method of financing compensation. Do you have any recommendations of what sorts of mechanisms are most efficient economically, real estate transfer tax or some kind of property tax or property transfer tax of some kind?
Right. Let me start with the theoretical, and then I'll get into the perhaps the more practical. But from an economist's perspective, the efficient way to do this would be if we had a regulation that went into effect that we believe benefited a particular area, we would draw a circle around the area that we believe benefited from that regulation, and then we would see what the claims were with respect to claims for compensation related to that regulation. And then we would ask the voters within that area to increase their property taxes or their income taxes or some, you know, there'd be some vehicle to raise money to say, look, here are a number of individuals within this area who have said their property values have gone down through this regulation, but in general we believe that we have improved values within this area. Are you willing to pay that amount to keep that regulation in place? And so it'd sort of be an up or down vote within that area. And of course, regulations have different scopes of influence. So you can imagine some regulations would be that negotiation would be done at the neighborhood level. Other regulations would be done at a metropolitan area level, and other regulations would be done at the state level.
I think I've found the solution. It simply requires that every Oregonian get a PhD in economics. I think we've solved the problem.
Okay, that's why I said I'd start with the theoretical.
Tax everybody in Northwest Portland.
Now, with respect to specific policies, we did not get into in depth into research on specific revenue vehicles that would that could be used to finance this. But in preliminary conversations just around the office among the five authors, the real estate transfer tax is one vehicle that appears to be would be a viable candidate to generate revenues for this. I think in selecting a vehicle, you would want to start with something that was related to property, since most of this is property related. And the principle in selecting the vehicle would be trying to create a nexus between the revenue and what you're spending it on. So the more it can be related to increases in property values and a tax on property as opposed to a tax on income, the more rational it seems from the perspective of the people who have to pay it, and the fairer the perception of the ultimate system.
Thank you. Are there any other questions for Mr. Tapania? Okay, hearing none. Thank you very much. Appreciate you coming down today, and thank you again, Deidre and
sure.
Oregon Business Council, for the information. At this time, I'd like Mr. Dan Cooper to come forward from Metro, and anyone else he's going to bring with him.
Thank you, Chair Williams, members of the committee. I'm Dan Cooper. I'm Metro's general counsel. With me is Doug Riggs, who's from the PacWest firm, who's our legislative liaison this session. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify. Metro's council of seven elected members and executive officers have unanimously adopted a set of principles on Measure 7 issues that are being handed out to you now. And they believe that the issue that you are dealing with is probably the one of the biggest things, the challenges the legislature has faced probably in the last 10 years, and is certainly something that we think we urge you to continue to struggle to deal with and see if we can get the issue of regulatory fairness in the land use system resolved now and not have it come back to continue to haunt the state over the next 10 years in the same way as the property tax reform and initiative process has caused such great disruption to the state and local government over the last 10 years. I want to summarize for the record out loud what the principles are. The adoption by the voters in November of Measure 7 is a strong indication that the issue of regulatory fairness within the Oregon land use planning system is of grave concern and should be addressed decisively and as soon as possible. I'll summarize the next three bullet points by saying we don't like Measure 7 as written, and we believe that the recommendation we would give you as to what to do now is to go forward with a legislative referral of a constitutional amendment that simultaneously repeals the existing language in Measure 7 and sets forth principles for statewide land use planning and for the legislature to adopt statutory scheme for providing compensation to property owners. We think that the statutory provisions for compensation should provide a uniform process statewide for a locally determined system to provide a means to address regulatory fairness issues through limited waivers of regulatory requirements, alternative and incentive-based means of achieving regulatory objectives, payments of cash compensation. Compensation for meeting state-mandated requirements should be funded by the legislature, and in urban areas in particular, any requirement for compensation should be prospective only. We also want to note that, as set forth in the Attorney General's opinion on Measure 7, there are certain values of public resources, such as water and air, that while they might be considered private property by some in Oregon, have long-standing histories of not being private property. So private action that interferes with the right of the state to regulate the appropriation of water consistent with the system that the state has used for over 100 years should continue to be respected and not be considered the taking of private property when the state says no, the appropriation of water from this area is subject to state regulation, and we already know who has the water rights. Just because you own the lake doesn't mean you have the right to use the water where your downstream owners have already appropriated that and registered their rights of appropriation. We have not taken any position on retroactivity for rural areas on the lot of record issue or subdivision issues that are there. We've confined our principles to the urban areas, and I want to point out that in adopting these principles, the council and executive office recognize that there are principles, and coming here to this forum, we may need to address other people's ideas of what the system should be like, and we need to work forward towards something that we can all find a common ground on. The council and the executive have charged me and Doug and our firm as this is our highest priority this session. We would like to get this issue behind us. They've told me I can't spend enough time trying to work toward a solution in this manner. And I'd just like to add that we've been asked by the chair and the governor's office to take the lead on organizing the counties and coming up with some data that might give you some factual information about rural areas in terms of how many lots of record potentially are out there that have been deprived of the right to build a single family house, how many acres are potentially subdividable under old regulations where subdivisions are now prohibited, and we're working on coming back with as much data with whatever degree of reliability we can describe to it as quickly as possible. And with that, I'd take any questions and thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Doug, did you have anything to add? You're just up here to jump in front of Dan.
He's up here to kick me if I say
yeah,
anything.
Okay. Well, I want to start first by just thanking Dan and Metro for the help that they have provided. We put Dan in the breach a couple of different times on helping us gather data and work on issues, and he has been more than willing to do that, and I appreciate that and all the people who are really participating in on this effort. I know it's taking a lot of everyone's both business and personal time to try to address this issue. Are there questions for Mr. Cooper? Representative Beck.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dan, I'm wondering, this may be hard for you since you don't sit on the council, but what sorts of regulations that Metro has imposed do you perceive to be the sorts of regulations that Metro area citizens are anxious about? I mean, I'm thinking of Title III?
Title III. What we have on the books right now is what we call the 2040 Functional Plan, and it was our version of measures that the Metro Council took actually in 1997 in anticipation of meeting the requirements of House Bill 2709 as adopted in 1995, which said when you look at an urban growth boundary to determine whether you need to expand it or not, one of the things you should do is to look to see if you can take measures to make growth more efficient inside the urban growth boundary in order to avoid the need for expanding as much when you do move your urban growth boundary. And the council in 1996 adopted what they thought was going to be a balanced approach to that. On the one hand, cities and counties were going to be required to make more efficient use of the land consistent with their own expectations of how they could do that, so that each of the 24 cities and the three counties gave us target numbers of additional housing units that they thought they could fit within their boundaries in the next 20 years, and we tasked them with actually demonstrating that they had rezoned to do that. We anticipated we'd concentrate the additional density. Concentrate, that's good. Right week for that, thank you. Most of that was going to go in the corridors where there was additional transit and capacity, and not putting additional housing into existing neighborhoods. And also to make sure that in the suburban communities that had vacant land, that as development was approved, it was done on an efficient basis and not with too many large lot subdivisions and try to make more efficient use of the land. At the same time, there was a recognition that adding that much more density inside the existing urban growth boundary had to be balanced with some additional environmental protection. So what we refer to as Title III was the place where we were going to deal with goals 5, 6, and 7. Goal 5, you're probably all familiar with, natural resources, wildlife protection. Goal 6, stream quality. Goal 7, natural disasters. Stream quality and floods, water quality and flooding are the goal 6 and 7 components. And we adopted actual requirements under the goal 6 and 7 piece of Title III in 1997. And those called for minimum setbacks along streams and no build in wetlands unless you did balance cut and fill so that you didn't adversely affect the flood capacity of those wetlands and floodplains. Those regulations did impose certain restrictions on development on individual property owners. And when we adopted those regulations, we mandated that each of the local jurisdictions in implementing them had to have a variance process so that individual property owners would have a right to continue to build on their property if the effect of the setbacks that we were requiring was going to prohibit any building. If the lot was so close to a stream that our setback was going to mean there was no buildable area on that lot at all, or what was buildable was so constrained that it was really unbuildable, then we wanted to address that issue. We wanted the local governments to have a safety valve so that we didn't do what we believed under Lucas versus South Carolina would have been a taking at that time. Now, that's not the same test that Measure 7 would have applied, but it was a recognition on the council's part that we had to have some fairness and balance in that system. We are now continuing to work on a Goal 5 regulatory program consistent with the Goal 5 rule as adopted by the state. That's the area where the federal regulations now in effect under the Endangered Species Act and the 4D rules as adopted by the National Marine Fisheries Service would play a part. And that is an area where under anything, even the one we're proposing and discussing, we're going to have to be very careful on how we would go forward with any regulations and either be able to show that they are in fact required under federal law or will meet whatever compensation test would be required by the kind of statutory scheme we're recommending. And that's why we're very interested in making sure that there are alternatives to just paying cash. If there are incentive programs that can be developed, if there are alternatives to providing development transfers, limitations on property tax, limited property tax waivers, a whole mix of tools, we feel we could continue to make that effort, come up with a balanced regulatory scheme that greatly enhanced the metropolitan area's livability by protecting those resources, and at the same time, do it in a fashion that would be fair to the individual property owners.
Other questions?
Sure. Representative Beck?
That was a short answer.
I'll see if I can say yes or no to the next question.
This one will be a shorter answer, I think. Metro in 95, voters approved $135 million property tax bond for open space purchase.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beck, yes.
Great. Could you philosophize a little bit about any potential role that funding source has played in, maybe a few instances or just generally in terms of alleviating some landowners' concerns about perceived or actual burdensome regulations on their property? Has Metro been able, not acting to in any formal way to provide a taking, but to provide some relief through acquisition of landowners who felt burdened by local or regional regulations?
To philosophize for a very short minute, we think it's fair to say that bond measure was broadly supported by both the environmental community and the development community because they saw that as an opportunity to pay property owners for protecting land rather than regulating property owners into protecting land. That program is entirely a willing seller, willing buyer program. We have not condemned any property in acquiring the over 6,500 acres and over 180 transactions that we've done since we got the program rolling about 5 years ago. And it has been an important tool for Metro to acquire a lot of land in riparian corridors or in other areas that have been environmentally sensitive at negotiated prices that the property owners have agreed to sell at in order to achieve that kind of balance. And there's been more than one instance where we've acquired land where the property owner felt that they had a potential claim, and in more than one case, an active litigation against the local government for compensation on the theory that a taking had already occurred, and we in effect settled the case by buying the land at a price that the property owner agreed to sell for.
Representative Morgan.
You talked about tools in the compensation toolbox and the importance of having a broad base of alternatives there to deal with situations. I apologize for being late to the meeting, and I don't know whether you've discussed Metro's position on the concept of allowing a variance to development standards, and I wonder if you might give us the benefit of the discussions that have taken place about adding that tool to the toolbox.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, that's an important tool. We think it belongs in the toolbox. It goes part and parcel with, is the requirement state mandated, in which case one of our fundamental principles, if it's a state mandate, the state should be paying the compensation, or the state should be making it possible for the local government to vary the requirement in a way that would avoid the need to pay compensation. If it's a local government requirement, as we did in our Title III program, we think that a case-by-case variance method may be a very real way to achieve the same practical effects that the regulation was designed to achieve in protecting the environment and minimize the property owner's loss. So, yes, that's an important tool, and we think it belongs in the toolbox.
Further questions? Representative Schrader.
A couple of questions, if I may, sir.
Yes.
To follow up on Representative Morgan's question, so what you're suggesting is that it's not a variance in common planning parlance where you probably disallow the regulation necessarily, but you find alternative ways to get the same outcome but being a little more flexible in doing so. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, basically yes. The variances from over in history on the land use regulation side have from time to time been sometimes it's an on and off switch, and sometimes it's a variance to the minimum extent necessary to allow something that otherwise couldn't happen and then still not cause harm. Variances on everything from side yards, how close to the street your garage can be. Often are used to tailor general regulation to specific lots.
Second question, sir.
Follow up.
You referred to private actions that reduce value of public resources and talked about authority that state and perhaps local jurisdictions may already have and not necessarily be compensable in your own mind. Is there any way, you gave the water was the example, water appropriation. Are there others that you could list and provide the committee with at some point in time?
Sure. I mean, in general, in the Attorney General's opinion, there was a section he discussed on the history of what is private property versus what is not. And it's that discussion in his opinion that one of our members of our council thought was really appropriate to make sure that we stated that principle. It was possible to construe the existing language of Measure 7 to have gone that far. In all of the discussions we've been participating with so far, no one is proposing that whatever compensation scheme be enacted would go that far, and so I think it's fair to say that's really not an issue that seems live, but it's an important principle that we thought needed to be remembered.
All right.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you, Dan. Appreciate it. Thank you, Doug. This time, we'll ask Craig Zell to come forward from the Appraisal Institute. Good afternoon, Craig. Do you have a written testimony?
I do not.
Okay, great. If you did,
I have a very short prepared remarks, and then I'm here to answer questions, really.
Great, thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representatives, my name is Craig Zell. I'm a certified general appraiser in the states of Oregon and Washington. My focus is on land and land value. I've been appraising for about 18 years. I've been in the real estate business and markets for about 29 years. I'm here on behalf of the Appraisal Institute to really answer any questions or educate those who might have questions on the appraisal process. I'd like to focus on a couple of general points up front. One, if and when a Measure 7 rewrite is adopted, appraisals need to be performed for any claim process. Two, appraisals need to be performed according to the Uniform Standards of Professional Appraisal Practice. That's a nationally recognized group of standards. It's contained in a book, a very large book, but we go to school for years to understand it. And to be completed by competent, licensed, and or certified appraisers in Oregon. Three, appraisals should generally, or when they are values over a certain threshold, need to be reviewed for compliance with standards and reasonableness of value by other competent appraisers. I can tell you for the last 4 years I have acted as the consultant and review appraiser for Metro's Open Spaces and Green Space program. In some ways, Mr. Cooper is my boss, having working for the general counsel. Again, I'm here to really answer or educate those who may have questions on the appraisal process. And finally, I'd like to stress that appraisal is an art and not a science. Although we apply many techniques that are somewhat scientific, appraisers are trained to observe the actions of the market, analyze those actions, and report on conclusions. I'll end by saying that the question of retroactivity has been brought up many times, and that the reliability of any appraisal is limited as you go back further in time. It becomes less reliable the further back you go. And with that, I'll answer any questions.
Thank you, Craig. And Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Craig, we had testimony by Eco Northwest about a givings tax, and they talked about surrounding properties being taxed according to the value that they're getting from a taking. What I'd like to know is, as an appraiser, things like riparian zones, wetlands, setbacks from streams, the value to that on surrounding property, is that something that you can quantify? Do you have anything, you know, in your science that you do right now that would quantify those types of things, or would that have to all be developed?
No, there are examples of purchases. The Metro Open Spaces program has many examples, actually, where appraisals have been performed for these types of lands or these types of property types. And there are neighbor-to-neighbor purchases. There are various conservation agency purchases. There are examples in the market where persons or other entities purchase property on an arm's length basis and not necessarily government purchases. So we can look at those and try to analyze the actions of those market participants.
Follow up. I guess specifically I'm wondering about if you could address a wetland. I'm trying to visualize how that gives value to the surrounding properties, monetary value. When they sell their home, Does it give them value or not?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is a very interesting study. When wetlands are integrated within a subdivision, for example, it enhances the individual lots that back up to the wetlands area or the open space or buffer area. Now, is value generated by the wetlands that generally has very little value, or is it all contained within the lot that has more utility? I think there's probably a give and take. Wetlands are purchased on a very, very low value per acre, where developable land is purchased on very high value per acre. So there was a study by Reed College that that actually identified a percentage adjustment for properties that back up to buffered land or open space or wetland, as you refer to. They, I believe, applied about a 10% premium to those lands that back up to those type of properties.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Beck?
Chair, a comment and a couple questions. A comment to Representative Close. I think I've heard of handfuls of studies all over the country about the relationship between open space and adjacent property values. Obviously, if you can live next to a 100-acre wetland with a view and versus subdivision, there's a lot of public record out there that shows those homes tend to rise in value. Just my own experience, my own legislative district, I represent two of the most affluent neighborhoods in the state. Both neighborhoods are adjacent to large open spaces, Northwest Portland Forest Park and Dunthorpe next to Tryon Creek Park. I think if you talk to any resident in those neighborhoods, they would tell you that one of the reasons they're willing to pay so much money is they're next to a protected area. That's just a comment. A question to Craig. If we were to march down this path and identify properties meriting compensation, would we, if a property has been regulated, let's say part of the property has been regulated, would the appraisers recommend that we appraise just the portion of the property that has been regulated, or would you actually appraise the entire property and subtract out? Is there a methodology for how a public agency would determine a value of the property? Is it the value of the whole or the value of the remainder? Is that something we should be addressing in statute, or is that something one would look at in administrative rule? Have any thoughts on all that?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Beck. There is methodology out there. It is commonly performed in condemnation proceedings. It's called a before and after appraisal. What is the value in the before situation without regulation or with common regulation? And what is the value in the after condition? In the state of Oregon, I believe the law says, and correct me, those attorneys who are present, the law says that a property owner may be compensated or will be compensated for the taking, but then we need to assess the damages to the remainder. When there is special benefits to a property, then those special benefits are subtracted from the damages, but not the taking. And in federal law, special benefits may be subtracted from the whole, the taking and the damages. So in answer to your question, a before and after analysis really needs to be studied on what was the highest and best use in the before condition and what is it in the after condition. And the difference in value is what is typically compensated or compensable.
Thank you. Further questions? Craig, I guess I have one that I'd ask, and this is... you don't even have to give the complete answer now, but it's one that I'd like the appraisers to be thinking of. As we begin to move forward with some sort of a framework on how we might consider addressing the Measure 7 issues and regulatory takings, I guess I'd like at some point the appraisers to come forward, because much of this will end up resting on the shoulders of the appraisers. Whatever piece we put in place, somebody's going to have to determine the impact on fair market value of people's individual properties. And to do that, like we've always done in condemnation and inverse condemnation cases, we've relied on appraisers to come forward and sometimes competing appraisals to come forward. And I've been involved in some of those cases. I guess what I'd like you to do, so we're thinking of it as a committee as we start to move into this process, is talk to your fellow appraisers and give us a list of what you think are the top 10, maybe the top 50 issues that we ought to be concerned about as it relates to the practical issue of where appraisals play a role in this process. Because the attorneys can noodle on some portion of this thing, and the land use advocates can noodle on some portion of this thing. But in the end, a lot of this is going to come down to the process by which the appraisers or the appraisals get handled and play a part in this. And you have a special role in helping us solve this problem. So I guess I just invite you to think about that as an association, as an institute. Come back to us with maybe some things that we ought to be considering as we're starting to deal with the concepts and then eventually the process by which claims might be made, points at which appraisals will be done, ideas about how to do, maybe quick appraisals at certain lower valued levels versus full-blown appraisers at higher value levels. So when there is compensation to be paid, it isn't all eaten up essentially in the process of processing the claim. Any suggestions like that you can come forward with, I think, are going to be helpful to the committee as we continue to start to move from the broader concepts into some of the more detail of proposals that we might be considering.
Mr. Chair, we'd be happy to consult with you and your committee on that. There has been much debate since November about the role of the appraiser. And as you all realize, I think in condemnation cases there are competing appraisers, and there are the battle of experts in the courtroom, and we would really like to try to get away from that because it gets ugly.
What I'll tell you is what I told someone else the other day: if my 9-year-old son were 10 years older, I'd be telling him to become a real estate appraiser. I think we've got a real market that's going to take off here at some point in this state. Representative Schrader?
A couple of questions. You indicated that the appraisal value becomes somewhat limited or not as accurate or whatever.
Less reliable.
As reliable. As you go back in time, and then you talked a little bit about the before and after type appraisal, which would be, I assume, slightly more accurate. And I guess I'm curious, is there a percentage of accuracy or some way we can get a handle on how far back we should be looking before it becomes untenable and you'd have appraisals all over the map and not accurate at all?
I have been, I don't have a specific answer to that question, I guess, but I can't imagine going back to 1950 and doing an appraisal on a property at that time with any reliability. I have been asked and have performed retrospective appraisals, I think as far back as 6 or 7 years, but my memory and I go back 18 years in the profession and 29 years in the real estate business, so I have some memory, and there are records that are available for at least that amount of time. I don't think anybody could go back and construct a market in 1950 or in 1970, and way too much has changed since that time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions? Okay. Thank you very much, Craig.
I appreciate you
coming down. Our last witness for this afternoon is Glenn Stonebrink from the Oregon Cattlemen's Association.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Glenn Stonebrink, and I'm with the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. The document's being passed out to you at the present time. I'm not going to read it, thank goodness, but more of a historical document on those places, along with my own comments, within the U.S. Constitution, the Oregon Constitution, and some of the intent. And I've also included your oath of office in there just for the fun of it. The one that I do want to camp on in the U.S. Constitution that's not talked about, I know there's been a lot of talk about the Fifth Amendment and so on of the compensation for takings, but the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution is interesting because while it has appeared to be to address the slavery issue only, you notice it says neither slavery nor involuntary servitude will be allowed except for punishment of a crime. And it seems kind of strange that the founders would say slavery nor involuntary servitude, because they sound the same. A servitude might be considered that we're going to take you and make you a servant. Unless you agree to that, that's illegal. Well, in researching this a little bit, of course, what I found was that there's two types of servitude. There's the personal servitude and a landed servitude. So while slaves were to be free, neither were we to put a servitude on their property, but it didn't just say on former slaves, it said on everyone's property, unless it was voluntary. And then that's what we have done with regulations by government, whether it be federal, state, in this case, of course, with Measure 7, we're talking about the state. And if by regulation or by law you place a control or a use on a piece of property, unless the property owner has agreed to it, or unless it's for a punishment for some crime, it's not allowed. And yet we've been doing that in quite a few places. And then the 14th Amendment, of course, was of the U.S. Constitution was designed because some states thought that, well, the federal government can't take your property, the states can take your property, and that's pretty obvious. They said, no, you can't do it either. The Oregon cattlemen are on record, and we did place an ad in the voters' pamphlet for Measure 7 in the last election. And I have also, on behalf of the Oregon cattlemen, debated with 1,000 Friends of Oregon on this issue prior to the election, and felt that through those debates and questions and comments after the debates, that the public was well informed as to what they were talking about and what we were talking about and what Measure 7 meant, that there really wasn't any uncertainty. I also, shortly after the election and the passage of Measure 7, had the opportunity to speak with the new agency head of the Division of State Lands, and that was before a court case and before the legislature started. And she made a very interesting comment about the passage of Measure 7. She said, during our staff meetings, we've talked about it a lot, and it certainly has brought us a reality check to any new proposed rules or regulations that we might pass. And I thought, well, that's good, but shouldn't that really have been in place all the time? That's what the role of government should be at all times, is what is this going to do to the value of people's property? So throughout the research that I've done and in the history that I've searched over a period of years, I should say, what I found that property and the use of property is one of the most valuable things that our country was founded on. And I would love to help this committee in any way in the future that I possibly can and help crafting something. I don't think it's something that the voters intend for it to be neglected, but that will be addressed. And I want to ask if there's any questions on any of this testimony. I want to take just a couple minutes to tell a personal land use issue, if I may. But I wanted to finish with this as the cattleman's first.
Why don't you go ahead, and then we'll see if there are questions.
May I use the board over here?
You may. You'll need to bring it close to the microphone so we can pick you up on the record.
In, before the land use laws were passed in the state, my wife and I, we have 162 acres in Polk County. It was purchased before the land use laws were put in place. Well, there were four tax lots. They weren't exactly equal. I'm going to just show them as roughly equal, because they were roughly equal at that time. In 4 years ago, we decided that we wanted to sell part of this property. And so we hired a consultant to go to the Polk County Land Use Department and say, how can we sell this? And what we have is about 32 acres here that's wooded, and we have a house on it. The rest of it is farmland, and part of it is somewhat of a wetland. And he suggested that we start off with getting a survey and taking this 80 acres and selling that farmland. We sold it to the gentleman who's farming the land presently. He had been leasing it, and he owns other land in the area. So that left us with approximately 82 acres, and we wanted to, and then we were told, after we do that, then you can do a land lot adjustment and sell another approximately 50 acres to the same farmer. It's a little bit less valued land, but it's the same farmer. He's growing grass seed on it. So we surveyed that, and we have over $12,000 in survey costs. And we thought, now this is fine. And when we got ready to make the deal, the Land Use Board of Appeals said, can't do it. I said, why? The county told us we could do this. We've already sold this 80 acres. And they said, because that leaves you with a house on less than 80 acres. We already have the house. We can't build any more houses on it. We know that, and we're not intending to. This would have to be 160 before he could build two houses on it. With just purchasing the 80, he could build one house. So there's no additional houses for neither us or the farmer who's purchasing this. But they simply said, well, that's the way the law is. You would end up with less than 80 acres and a house. On a house on less than 80 acres. So they stopped us from selling 50 acres of farmland to a farmer. We don't have farm equipment. We've both been farmers in the past. We don't have farm equipment. And if this farmer, luckily, he goes ahead and leases this land, but we're at the end of the road where the farmland is. But if he chose not to, it would be difficult to get someone to move their equipment to come down and farm this 50 acres of rather poor farmland for the area. So we said, okay, this is wrong, but I guess we're going to be stuck with it. And so we said, all right, let's undo this. Let's undo this whole thing. Give us back our four lots. He said, no, we can't do that because you've already divided it and sold us off. But we did it at the advice of not only the person we hired, but with the planning director in Polk County. And so we'll bring the planning director in Polk County forward. We'll testify. Well, he's retired and he's no longer here. These are some of the catch-22s that we get into with the land use. And it simply said, well, we can't do it because that's the way the law is. So we're not that we mind being so-called stuck with it, but I thought I would use that as an example. Something's happened to us to tell some of the stories. Now, Measure 7 could come along and we could say, okay, then maybe we can sell. Either you let us sell this land to this farmer, which is all we want to do. We're not talking about building any more houses. Or you pay us a difference because we now have this little small lot down here, smaller piece of property, that could put us in jeopardy. I mean, maybe the difference would only be $500 or $600, but pay us the difference or let us sell this land to them, which would be no harm to anyone. So I think what we find, especially in the land use arena, that there are a number of, if everybody thinks that if Measure 7 passes, everybody wants to develop their land, and that's not true. And I think a lot of people wouldn't qualify to start with because they bought the land after the regulations are in place. A lot of people wouldn't want to do anything. A lot of people would want to do something like what we're talking about. So I don't think the $5.4 billion cost is a realistic figure.
Good. Thank you. I appreciate you sharing that with us, Glenn. Are there questions for Glenn? Okay. Appreciate your testimony very much and your willingness to come forward and help us. That is the conclusion of the testimony that we're going to have today, colleagues. I hope you'll take a look at the materials that were provided. I'm hopeful that we'll have another committee meeting next week where we'll talk a little bit more about the framework that we're developing at that time. The committee staff will be getting a hold of you to try to schedule a time for that. So with that, the hearing is adjourned.